Joining me from Chicago is the author and creator behind Jimmy Corgan, The Smartest Kid on Earth. Hiya, Chris Ware.
Hi.
Now, what I find really startling about the book, which is basically a collection of all the strips of Jimmy Corgan that appeared since starting in 1993, is that you started this out as an improv sort of exercise, meant to be a short little thing. That you would work out some issues, father issues, over the course of a summer. When did you notice that this thing was getting out of hand?
I guess after the time limit that I'd set for myself expired, which was about 3 months or so, and I realized that I hadn't even gotten past any sort of a respectable introduction with it yet. So, and then about 6 years later was when I finally wound it up, I suppose. So I just got out of hand. I'm not really a writer, or at least certainly back then I wasn't, and it just sort of got out of hand, I suppose. So I started putting more and more into it, and having to account for more and more, and letting my mind go where it wanted to go, and so that's what happened.
Well, what I don't get is how it could have begun as an unplanned improv exercise.
Really?
It seems to
be wholly without any structure or respectable sort of things that you expect from good writing. It seems to me to be really meandering and wandering. So,
well, what was the beginning premise then?
Just simply that this character was going to meet his father, whom he'd never met before, and it kind of grew from there, I guess. So, I had all sorts of weird ideas, most of which I can't remember for the original story, but. And in a lot of cases, I can't even remember why I did certain things, so I'll say again in advance that you may ask me why I did a certain thing, and I, in some cases, I can't even remember why I did it, or even worse, I'll find myself manufacturing an answer just to fill space. So,
okay.
When you work on something for that long, and when I finished it too, I suddenly forgot a great deal of it, so. I don't know what that means exactly. I think there's something endemic to cartooning that causes brain damage, but I'm not sure. So you sit at a table by yourself for a really long time in this world that transpires incredibly slowly in like the slowest of motion. That I think there's definite physiological damage that happens.
As a done thing, though, Chris, when you now that it's like a big 380-page object, how do you feel about it?
You know, I don't know. I guess, I mean, I'm glad I'm done with it, and I think it's, I don't know. I'm glad.
I mean,
I'm
is it a done thing? Do you consider it a done thing now?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't want to draw that character anymore. I don't feel, there's something that happens when you draw comic characters, and it probably happens with real writers too, that all of a sudden, when you're done with a certain story, or maybe even before you're done with a certain story, the characters quit telling you what to do. They quit living in a way, in a sense, I guess they die. So that's sort of what happened with the Jimmy Corrigan character.
Somebody came up with, I don't know how accurate this is, just kind of like how it sounds too, but they sort of described the whole story as an illustrated Freud. Because you're getting, did you like that?
Sure.
Well, because you are really getting at the psychological details between these generations of Corrigan men, their relationships to each other, history, the world, and clearly there's, and you've sort of admitted that in the little dust jacket, that there's an element of autobiography that's going here, that's in it. But did Jimmy lead you to any sort of calming, therapeutic conclusions of your own?
Well, I wish I could say yes, but not really. And I mean, the problem being, of course, like I mentioned in the afterword of the book, that my real dad, whom I'd been avoiding meeting my entire life, and who I met through his action about halfway through this story, or making the story, died, and I only met him once. So that sort of makes it permanently irresolute, I guess. But yeah, I don't know. Again, I wish I could say yes, but I don't really think so.
Well, because you did say that it was a way of working out stuff for yourself. I mean, do you feel it has it worked it out? Have you worked whatever it is out?
I don't think so. I wish I could say yes or have a more interesting, engaging answer, but I don't really think I did. Not that it even really would matter to anybody other than me. So, and that's part of the problem of doing something like this, where you risk being so utterly self-indulgent and ponderous that nobody will care, or even worse, they'll actually be angry at you for being so self-indulgent. So,
did that happen in any of the? Did you get any sort of feedback like that?
I've read a few reviews of it, or heard some things where people might have thought that, or they thought that I was simply trying to depress them, which I certainly wasn't trying to do. But for the most part, I've been actually very surprised by the generous response that it's received, as they say.
Well, I think part of that is just the excruciatingly devastating visual and text detail that you've poured into. It is really very breathtaking. Like the dust jacket alone could make a person cry. But you've said this: comics are ill prepared to deal with emotions more complicated than scorn and slapstick. And clearly, you've surpassed that as a restriction with Jimmy Corrigan. But why do you think comics are ill prepared to deal with more complex sort of emotional states?
Well, there's something about comics that's endemically distancing to the reader. They're like, when I talk about limericks, there's something about the safety of a comic strip. When you're looking into a comic strip, you're watching pictures of people. You're not involved in it necessarily in the way you can be in a novel, where you can navigate through different characters' minds and through the mind of a narrator and back and forth almost seamlessly without having to even be aware of what you're doing. But in a comic strip, you're always on the outside looking in, so it's a problem of empathy with a character and a reader, and there's various tricks and ways of trying to get around that.
Well, what are some of your strategies then?
Well, strategy, yeah, geez. That's a word they taught us in art school. I guess, initially, I felt that showing a bunch of different characters' faces in one picture was confusing in a way, and it distanced the reader even more, so I would try to deliberately hide faces or hide facial reactions, except for the main character, because for some reason, when you're looking at the main character, you're identifying more with him or her. But that gradually sort of, I just unconsciously kind of got away from it, probably because it was a stupid idea, but maybe because it was just endemically limiting. So, another problem is the way comics are drawn, I think, and sometimes if an artist is a little bit too expressive in his line, or maybe it's only in my case, it can get in the way of the understanding of the story. So I try to keep my drawing as simple as possible, almost like typography in a way. I sort of think of it there's something about comics where you're looking at them, but at the same time you're not necessarily seeing them in the same way that you see a painting or a really good drawing. You're sort of looking through them in the way that you look through words when you're reading. You don't actually look at the typography or the fibers of paper when you're reading. You're simply processing the words. So it's a different kind of seeing that you're doing than you do when you look at art. So,
are there people who you think who are successfully sort of getting at these sorts of expressing more complicated emotions?
Sure. Yeah, there's tons of great cartoonists doing stuff like that. Like Dan Clowes is one of my favorites, one of my heroes, and Art Spiegelman and Robert Crumb, Kim Deitch, Ben Catcher, certainly, and a host of Canadian cartoonists too, Seth and Chester Brown and Joe Matt, Julie Doucet, David Collier. There are countless cartoonists, and I think there's actually probably more people doing self-revelatory or self-revealing comics of a personal nature now than there ever have been. And I don't know, that sounds sort of optimistic, I guess, but I don't know.
Do you think there's a shift in sort of the cultural context in which comics are consumed, maybe?
I wish. Maybe in Canada there is. In America, I don't know. It just seems hopeless.
Well, you were lamenting somewhere the sort of the death of the daily comic strip.
Was I? That sounds terrible.
Well, did you think there was a time when it was vibrant as a sort of a social and cultural form?
Well, I'd like to think so, but maybe I just have the benefit of hindsight and looking back and editing history, because you just looking back 75 years, you can choose to look at the comic strips that you are only interested in. You're not confronted with the daily strip page the way you would be, say, in 1920 or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely think that there was more of a sense of experimentation and a personal quality to comics almost a century ago now, so maybe 80 years ago or so.
Now, some people argue Charlie Brown, though, was the first modern existential hero in a way.
I would agree, actually. I think I was actually asked to write something for an upcoming book about Charles Schulz that my friend Chip Kidd is working on. And he asked me to write from a cartoonist point of view about Charlie Brown and Charles Schulz. But it actually didn't end up making it into the book. But I realized when I was writing about it that Charlie Brown is really genuinely the first and maybe only sympathetic cartoon character ever created. He's a character you genuinely care about. And I sat thinking, can I think of any other cartoon character that I really care about? And Charlie Brown was about the only one. There are other ones that you sort of care about, but not as much as Charlie Brown, and you genuinely feel for him and you feel through him, and I think that's the great genius of Charles Schulz, actually.
So it's not a coincidence that a lot of people have picked up on Jimmy Corrigan as being a very Charlie Brown sort of character. He also has that sort of lumpen baby old man thing going on as well.
Yeah, well, that's just because that's what I look like, so...
But why is your self-portrait a robot? Oh, that's another story, sorry.
Well, there's a line of thinking that goes that the less information you present about a character visually, the more apt you might be to empathize with that character. And it seems sort of cut and dried, and that may be true and it may be false, but I think there's a certain amount of truth to it. But, so certainly it's true in Charlie Brown's case, or it seems to be true. There's a whole bunch of characters, like Barnaby and Henry and Skeezix.
Mm.
And even the yellow kid, these bald children, I don't quite understand it, but one could make a case, certainly, that there's something there to that idea, so.
There's being a good artist and being a good writer, I know not everybody in comics gets it free in an equal sort of balanced quantity. What has been your evolution in each of these areas? Did you start off stronger in one than the other, or have they grown up together?
I've started out weak in both, and I think I've stayed not so great in both. I've tried. I don't know. I think in being a cartoonist, you have to be good at both simultaneously, and I think comics genuinely, you can't really separate the two. In comics, there are a bunch of awards that are given out every year that are sort of like the Academy Awards or the Emmy Awards or Plumbing Awards or something, I don't know, but they separate out the various tasks of the people that are supposed to make comics as per the system that was established during the Great Depression to crank out as much junk as possible, i.e. you have a writer, you have a penciler, you have an inker, you have a letterer, you have a binder, a panel border maker, or whatever. So there's awards given for all those different categories, but it seems to me, being a cartoonist, you have to do all of those things seamlessly and unselfconsciously simultaneously, so that when I write, and when you were asking about improvisatory writing, it's done, I do it in that way because I want to write and think in pictures and words simultaneously. I don't write scripts ahead of time. So there's something about that when you're drawing or writing with pictures where certain things come up in your memory that I am pretty convinced would probably not come up as richly or complexly as they do. Wait, I lost my train of thought.
Well, I mean, what you're really talking about, though, is a language specific to comics, right?
Right, exactly. What I was trying to say is that in writing that I don't think necessarily they'd come up quite as richly. Or when you think of things visually, you think of them differently than when you think of them in words, or at least I do. So,
well, I was really struck by the pacing of each little story thread, because things in mix, it's a sort of a mix of a present, flashbacks, fantasy scenarios, but in the pacing, in the various frames, and the way your eye has to travel across the page, there's this creation of time passing, and the technique's quite amazing. It almost determines, you pick speeds in a way, at how quickly, you know, the eye grasps the idea visually and with the text. I mean, is this something that you're conscious of, or?
Yeah, when I'm working on a strip, I reread it hundreds of times because I sort of think of it like almost like a player piano roll or something. Like it's a pre-punched, ready-made, pre-paced sort of thing that you read through at a certain rate. And if the rhythm of it doesn't seem genuine, if it doesn't come off feeling like it would, if it was really happening, then I've got to add in another panel or take a certain panel out or just do something to make it seem right, because there's a natural rhythm to life and experience, I think, that people are unconsciously attuned to, that if you don't get that in a comic strip, then it's going to seem false. And unfortunately, I think some mainstream cartoonists try to go for the rhythms that are particular to motion pictures or television, which is sort of fast-paced cutting and doesn't have anything to do actually with real life whatsoever. So
And the strip is just a storyboard for narrative or something, right?
yeah. Well, I
Yeah.
mean, I think probably the greatest power of comics is to create this rhythm of life in a way that when you read it, it just suddenly feels right. It feels like experience. And I mean, you could certainly do that in a movie, but it's different when you're reading it because you're sort of playing it through in your mind. So I don't know, though. I probably think about it way too much, actually. So.
The other thing about you, Chris, is the miniatures that you do, the little cutouts so you can build toys, the models of the sets that are drawn in the strips. And is there a more accurate term for them? What do you call them?
I call them cutouts.
Okay.
You can call them whatever you want.
The little like build yourself doodad things.
Right.
With those, do you cut them out and build them to see if, do you do test engineering on your cutouts?
I suppose I should, but generally, by the time I get around to doing them for the comic book, I'm already late, so I just have to kind of hope that they work. I've done that for two of them, I think, that seem really complicated, so the one on my next issue is probably more complicated than it needs to be, so.
Is it true that there's people who buy a couple copies of Acme Novelty Library and cut one out and keep the other one?
I don't know about that. I've been accused of being a shrewd businessman and doing that to try to get people to buy two copies, but I'm not, that's not my aim. It's just to try to make something that seems like it's worth what you pay for it,
Well,
so.
where does this interest come from? Because I can remember weird toys from when I was a kid that you would build yourself this way, but it's maybe just vague in the back of my mind, this memory sensation of folding stuff up into little houses.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I really, there's something about it that just seems genuinely innocent and fun to me. I don't know. I loved cutout books or activity books probably more than anything when I was a kid. I don't really know why, and I still do, I guess. So there's just something about the promise in a piece of paper being made into something that seems really fragile and sort of sad that I really like. So. Plus, there's something about if you can make it actually do something, it's almost miraculous in a way, so.
Well, I mean, some people call it meticulous. Do you have another word to describe the
Maybe it's just dumb. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Just try to make it as, I hope that they work. I've made some slight measurement errors, I guess, in some of them, which I've gotten taken to task for,
What
so.
do people write you and tell you when you've failed architecturally?
Yeah, I feel bad about that too. I try to double check every measurement, so.
Well, there's one of the big recurring sort of flashbacks in the Jimmy Corrigan book is centers around the World's Fair that took place in Chicago in 1893. And again, there's this breathtaking sort of detail. How honest is the detail in the way that you portray the World's Fair? Like, did you research it really carefully?
I researched it a lot. I bought books and books and books of it. I found photographs. I actually got a three volume set portfolio of photographs that actually belonged to a woman that had exhibited paintings there. And I thought that this part of the book was going to take up, tons of pages, and of course it ended up just taking 10. But I walked around Jackson Park, which is where it happened, a number of times and tried to get a feel for the space of it. I can't say whether it's honest or not. I mean, I tried to make it as accurate as I possibly could. But there are just certain things that you have to do when you're telling any story that's based on something that happened, where you have to compress or stretch or do all sorts of things just to simply make it work within your own limited schema. So one of the things being is that in this, the Jimmy Corrigan story, I have Midway Airport located about half a mile away from where the Columbian Exposition took place, which of course it's not. It's many, many miles away, but it's also sort of a joke because there's a part of every World's Fair that was called the Midway, which is where all the lurid concessions and things like that were established, which is actually still there, and it's part of the University of Chicago now. Mm. It's just a big open green field, but I tried to make it as accurate as I possibly could, but it was just really hard to draw. But it was fun to draw at the same time. It's just so amazing to me that so much effort and time was put into something like that. And
when each city hosted its World's Fair, you mean?
Yeah. I mean, Chicago was obviously, it was the biggest one. I remember finding pictures of it. Actually, when I was a kid, my grandmother had a brochure from, I think it was, it's either 1898 or 1899, I think it's 98, Trans-Mississippi Exposition, which was in Omaha, Nebraska, of all places, and sort of a miniaturized version of the Columbian Exposition. And I could not reconcile the fact that that actually had transpired, even though she guaranteed me that it had, and there were pictures of it, and I felt the same way when I found out about the Chicago Exposition. I think most people that don't know about it, when they see pictures of it, simply can't believe that that would have happened in Chicago. So
why?
Just because it seems so ridiculously grand and overblown, and today's world is so ridiculously not grand and underblown and almost grim in a way that and the fact that it wouldn't be there, like, why put so much effort into something like that that was made out of plaster and horsehair and then burned down a year after it was built?
Well, it all seems to harken back to what's been a sort of your well-documented interest in things not of the now. I guess nostalgia might be the word. You've gone on record saying that that you're not very into popular culture or very into the now. What do you find more attractive about the period before now?
Well, I suppose, I mean, I've said this before too, I'm starting to sound like a broken record or an insane street shuffler or something, but there's just something about the remains from that time period that seems to me to have more of a respect for whoever might happen to be looking at it, either in its the care that went into it or the dignity or sometimes even the foolhardiness of it, that a company would choose some Greek god to represent itself on, you know, on their stamped logo that would be screwed onto the side of their product or something. And it seems to be, maybe it's just, again, just the benefit of hindsight or something. Maybe it was just as, I mean, there's certainly, I'm not nostalgic for the 19th century, you know, with cholera and lynchings and things like that. That are terrible. But there's something about the architecture and the typography and even the music of the time that I seem to feel a little more comfortable with. That's probably because I'm really repressed or something. I don't know.
So no power windows bring back the vitrola, right?
I don't know. I mean, I've got a computer. I've got all sorts of the modern conveniences. That's for sure. So I play my cylinders with an electrical pickup, though. So it makes them sound better. So I couldn't do that back then.
What was it? I mean, did you grow up in Chicago or did you grow up in Texas?
I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska.
Are you in Chicago for the architecture? Is that part of the attraction?
It was sort of the attraction, I guess. I came here to go to graduate school at the Art Institute in 91, and I was living in Austin, Texas before that. And I was definitely looking forward to being around old buildings because there aren't that many in Texas, or the few that were there were actually covered over with siding or false modernist fronts, which have actually since been ripped down, which is good. It seems like that attitude has improved over the past 10 years, that there's actually an urge to try to bring these things back or preserve what's left, and that everything that was, there's an awareness of all the stuff that was ripped down and ruined in the 60s and 70s. So
Well, it seems there's a bit of a rivalry between Manhattan and Chicago for who's got, like, the coolest stuff as far as old buildings go. I mean, do you clearly fall on the Chicago side, or are you...
No, definitely not. I mean, Chicago's not a bad place, and it's certainly better than it was 10 years ago, but, I mean, I don't think there's any question that New York has... New York is just its own place, you know. Chicago is... People that visit Chicago from New York seem to, they think, oh, it's the city of architecture. You know, well, yeah, maybe, you know, before they ripped everything down, you know. They've got all these rotten Mies van der Rohe buildings now to look at. They're trying to preserve while they're falling apart. But anyway, I'm sorry. I shouldn't complain about that stuff. So,
well, Chris, the Jimmy Corgan book's actually, it must be getting on its first anniversary, right, that it's been out?
God, I guess it's true. 1 year older already. Oh, boy. Yeah.
What is taken up has been taking up your time in comics since then?
Just doing the weekly strip. It's the same old thing, I guess. So, trying to finish my next issue. It's not a very exciting life. It's not like I'm, you know, I don't have a talk show or anything like that. So, probably for good reason, as you can tell. So, but yeah, I've been working on a story called Rusty Brown, which is very tangentially related to a series of gag strips I was doing about a collector type. Kind of toy collector type, and this is he and his best friend as kids in Omaha, Nebraska, not surprisingly.
This doesn't describe you in any way, does it?
Oh, no, it has nothing to do with me at all, so. There's a whole bunch of other characters in it, and it may just be a horrible, horrible mistake, but that's what I've been working on, so.
So, Chris, why is your self-portrait a tin man with no face?
Well, it's on one hand, it's sort of a joke on the expressiveness of my drawing style, which is sort of, I guess, a-expressive, or non-expressive, or whatever. And, I don't know, also, I just don't want to circulate too many pictures of myself. Yeah, plus there's something about it. I kind of like the robot metaphor, the idea of being trapped in a tin suit. I don't know why, it seems to...
Oh, you're your own factory, your own comics factory.
Yeah. Well, for the Jimmy Corgan character, who I first used this metaphor for, it just seemed to sort of fit his personality, I guess, and kind of trapped in his own skin, I guess, or something, unable to contact anybody or something. I don't know. Talking about it makes it sound really stupid, though. So,
Chris, I'd really like to thank you for coming in.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me.
All right. Bye.
Well, piece by piece.